Support for this podcast comes from Dice.com, the career hub for tech. With their new salary predictor, Dice makes it easier for you to understand how much your skills are worth. They'll even show you which skills are most likely to increase your pay. And with over 70,000 tech jobs, you'll be able to put those skills to good use when you find your next role. Dice is always free for job seekers, so visit dice.com/canyouhackit to see how you can start hacking your career today.
Welcome to Marijuana, Compassion, and Common Sense, the show that tells you the truth about marijuana, reveals the politics behind its prohibition, gives you the facts and information about its legendary health and medical benefits, and tries to clear up all that legal mumbo-jumbo that makes it so difficult, so dangerous, and nearly impossible for you to avail yourself of this ancient medicinal herb. Welcome to today's show and tomorrow's show and next week's show of Marijuana Compassion. Compassion and Common Sense. Thank you so much for logging into the show. That's right, you log in, you don't tune into Marijuana Compassion and Common Sense. And we're glad that you are joining our vast international audience of listeners to the show that's been telling the truth about marijuana for the last 9 years. So we're going to be doing a great show, and we have a wonderful show for you tonight. Our guest is Rick Doblin, who founded the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies way back in 1986. He's the executive director of this organization. It's an organization that studies and extols the role of psychedelics and marijuana in science, medicine, therapy, spirituality, culture, and policy. Doblin has paid his dues, really, to be, you know, this is kind of an off-the-wall way you might think. Well, he has paid his dues because, and he deserves to be listened to. He has received his doctorate in public policy from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where he wrote his dissertation on the regulation of the medical uses of psychedelics and marijuana. He wrote his master's thesis on a survey of oncologists, those are people who study cancer, about smoked marijuana versus the oral THC pill in nausea control for cancer patients. His undergraduate thesis at the New College of Florida was a 25-year, I think it was a 34-year follow-up to the classic Good Friday experiment, which evaluated the potential of psychedelic drugs to catalyze religious experiences. I got mixed up here. I'm sorry, my eyes jumped here, and Rick can correct me when he bring him on to the show. But he also conducted a 34-year follow-up study to Timothy Leary's Concord prison experiment, which administered psilocybin-based meds to 32 prisoners. Now get this. In an effort to reduce recidivism. I want to talk to him a little bit about that. His professional goal is to help develop legal context for the beneficial uses of psychedelics and marijuana, and primarily as a prescription medicines, but also for personal growth for otherwise healthy people, and eventually he wants to become a legally licensed psychedelic therapist. Well, that, we've got a lot of questions, you see? A lot of questions there. We're going to be asking about all that. I'm sorry I a little messed up my reading here. My eyes kind of jumped around a bit there. But anyway, I've met Rick many times at different conferences. I've attended most recently at the International Drug Policy Forum that was held in Atlanta by the Drug Policy Alliance. These are incredible things. I have talked about them on the shows before. If you ever have a chance to attend one of these international drug policy forums, it is something not to be missed. Definitely something that should be on your bucket list and more than just once. Okay, well, before we get to Rick, I always have a little op-ed here I want to present to you, and this one is This one's kind of an unusual one. This one's not political. This one is in deference to Rick Doblin. This is more on the on science than on politics. But you know, marijuana's impact on short-term memory is one of its most notable and often criticized attributes. Never mind that it can reduce dependence on opioids, antipsychotics, insomnia medications, and decrease alcohol consumption. Forgetting where you left your keys is deemed a greater danger. As it turns out, not only is forgetting where you left your keys no big deal, it may even be beneficial. New research, Paul Franklin and Blake Richards of the University of Toronto, and published in Neuron, a peer-reviewed journal for the neuroscience community, concluded that forgetting actually makes us smarter. In an interview on health.com, study researcher Richards explains, quote, "It's important that the brain forget irrelevant details and instead focus on the stuff that's going to help make decisions in the real world," end quote. Rather than just retaining information, the supposition is that memory functions to enhance intelligent decision-making by retaining what's important and removing what's not. Those who criticize marijuana for its purported short-term memory loss retain the view that memory is all about remembering. The new research places forgetting on par with remembering. The authors conclude in their research paper that it is the interaction between remembering and forgetting, quote, that allows for intelligent decision-making in dynamic, noisy environments, end quote. Significantly, it would seem that marijuana's ability to enhance forgetfulness allows for more than just intelligent decision-making. By blocking or erasing traumatic memories from memory regions of the brains, marijuana provides more comfort and aid to sufferers of PTSD than any prescription pharmaceutical. A previous study by author Paul Franklin found the connections made by new brain cells being created in the hippocampus overwrite old memories. The hippocampus is intimately involved in memory retention, as it plays an important role in the consolidation of information from short-term memory to long-term memory. Since marijuana has been shown to facilitate the creation of new brain cells in the hippocampus, it is a reasonable hypothesis that the very creation of these new neurons are responsible for some of the purported short-term memory loss attributed to marijuana use. Rather than being detrimental, Richards asserts the elimination of old memories caused by the creation of new neurons can be beneficial as, quote, if you're trying to navigate the world and your brain is constantly bringing up conflicting memories, that makes it harder for you to make an informed decision, end quote. Marijuana might cause you to forget where you left car keys when it would be convenient to know where they are. Of greater significance is that marijuana can help you forget where you left your car keys when you no longer need to know you left them on the dining room table because you put them in your pocket several hours ago. Quote, here's what Richard says, quote, you don't want to forget everything, and if you're forgetting a lot more than normal, that might be cause for concern. But if you're someone who forgets the occasional detail, that's probably a sign that your memory system is perfectly healthy and doing exactly what it should be doing, end quote. In other words, you forgot where you left your keys. No big deal. Expanding on Franklin's research that the creation of newer neurons can cause some memories to be lost, Richard emphasizes the importance of forgetting these old and insignificant memories through the creation of new neurons by touting the benefits of exercise. Quote, this is what Richard says. We know that exercise increases the number of neurons in the hippocampus, but they're exactly those details from your life that don't actually matter and that may be keeping you from making good decisions, end quote. Not that marijuana should replace exercise, but if the loss of memories from exercise is beneficial, why should we freak out over the loss of memories from marijuana when, just like exercise, marijuana can help reduce pain, mitigate psychotic symptoms, and facilitate a good night's sleep? Isn't that food for thought? All this loss about, I've always had so many, you know, this memory loss thing to me was always so much of a red herring that, you know, it's no big deal if you forgot where you left your keys. But now it actually turns out that this memory loss that marijuana brings about is actually a very, very good thing. Okay, all right. Well, another very, very good thing is that we have Rick Doblin in our studio here with to talk about the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies and all these things. You know, I grew up in the 60s. Timothy Leary and psychedelics, and by golly, I did them, and I don't regret them for a moment, and I certainly don't regret having Rick Doblin on our show. Rick, welcome to Marijuana Compassion Common Sense.
Hello, Larry. Thank you for not regretting having me. And, I thought it was very interesting.
Rick, could you talk a little closer? Rick, are you on a speakerphone?
No, I'm on. Can you hear me now?
Much better. Much better. Okay. Yeah, it sounded like you were talking in a pipe a moment ago.
Okay. Go. Yeah.
So you were saying.
Yeah, just I thought it was very interesting what you just said about memory. Because one of the things we're learning about MDMA-assisted psychotherapy and how we work with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it applies in different ways to marijuana, where we have a marijuana PTSD study in Arizona and also MDMA, in that there's what's going on, what's called memory reconsolidation. And so what happens is that if you have a traumatic experience, and every time you remember that, it makes you anxious and it makes you nervous, and that's kind of what PTSD is like. With MDMA, when you're feeling safe and your amygdala, the part of your brain that's near the hippocampus, but that processes fear-based memories, when MDMA reduces activity in the amygdala, so people feel safe, particularly when they look at difficult emotions. So when you can then process and experience difficult emotions from this position of safety, when the memory gets reconsolidated in your brain, you've swapped the feelings of anxiety with the feelings of safety. And then in the future, when people remember it, they're able to remember it from that position of safety, and then they're not traumatized by it as much. And so memory and memory reconsolidation are a key aspects for the therapy that we're doing with MDMA. But marijuana is a little bit different in that with marijuana, it helps people not have nightmares. It helps them focus on the present. But it doesn't have that same effect on the memory reconsolidation the way that MDMA does. So marijuana for PTSD is more of a daily treatment, a palliative treatment that helps with a lot of the symptoms and helps people a lot, but doesn't solve the problem in the sense that if they stop smoking marijuana, a lot of times the problems return. And so it's very interesting that you decide to focus on talking about memory.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say it's more of a palliative treatment for treating pain. Marijuana is more of a palliative treatment for almost everything it does, like for pain. It doesn't cure the pain. It's a palliative treatment for pain. It doesn't cure the problems causing insomnia. It's a palliative treatment for insomnia and so forth and so on. So I see marijuana as providing symptomatic, therapeutic symptomatic use, but it's not so much of a curative as it is. And frankly, most of the medicines, prescription medicines we take are not curative, they're palliative.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, in fact, when we worked with the FDA, we had a teleconference to discuss the marijuana PTSD study, which we're doing with Dr. Sue Sisley and 76 veterans. And it's being conducted in Phoenix, Arizona. But at the end of this teleconference, I explained to the FDA that our priority was MDMA-assisted psychotherapy because that offers the opportunity for a cure, whereas MDMA, you know, whereas, you know, and then you don't need MDMA afterwards. But with marijuana, it's more palliative, and people often use marijuana for a very long time. And the head of the FDA Division of Psychiatry Products was on the call, Tom Loughran, and he said, Rick, you do not have to apologize for just treating symptoms. Because in psychiatry, that's about all we do. So I think there's a lot of benefit for marijuana for PTSD.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of medicine, all the doctors is giving you palliative treatments to allow your body to make yourself healthy again. And so a lot of what medicine is just palliative, not really curative. Well, this is really fascinating. Listen, how did you ever get started in studies of psychedelics? What brought you? I mean, it looks like you've been kind of interested in that since you were an undergraduate student a long time ago.
Well, I actually decided on this path for my life when I was 18 years old in 1972. And actually, I have three children. One of them is 22, 21, and 19. And neither of them know what they want to do with their lives yet. And so I feel like I'm very, very lucky that I have this idea at 18 that still makes sense to me. In 9 days, I'll turn 64. So from 18 to 64, it still makes sense. But what got me into it was a sequence of three primary, looking back on it, I recognize that there was three primary influences that made me focus on the mind and psychology. The first one was growing up, you know, born in 1953, growing up to Jewish family shortly after the Holocaust, after World War II, and just realizing about how irrationality and cultural insanity were a threat to me and my family and my community. And so that just made me think about the mind and how people can project outward and demonize and dehumanize others and how scary that was. And so that made me think that, you know, look, you know, there's so many people that were killed in the Holocaust. They had enough money to live. They had enough money to eat and for shelter, but they still died from psychological factors. Then was growing up in the 50s as a young boy with the arms race with the Russians. And I remember in school, you know, learning duck and cover. You know, if there's a nuclear weapon, you know, go underneath your desk and you'll survive.
Right. I remember doing that in elementary school all the time, yes.
Yeah, it was just, so then it was like not just the Jews were in danger, but the whole world was in danger. And then was the Vietnam War, where I was the last year of the lottery. And so now it's not just the evil Germans or the Russians. Now it's my own government doing stuff that's nuts, that is deadly and destructive and counterproductive. So it just led me to think about what kind of solutions would there be to build a more peaceful world. And it seemed to me that the solutions were going to be psychological, not technological. You know, Albert Einstein said that our technology has exceeded our humanity. And so I felt like we need to figure out how to expand our humanity. But I believed all the propaganda about marijuana and about psychedelics as I was growing up. I really didn't do these drugs in high school, thought that they were terribly dangerous and brain damaging. And if you used LSD just a few times, you're in major trouble. And, you know, six or seven times and you were certifiably insane. All these things I believed because I didn't really know any better. But then I read a book, and this book turned me all around. And it was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest by Ken Kesey. And I loved the book. And a friend of mine said, hey, the author wrote some of it while he was under the influence of LSD. And I'm like, that's not possible. You know, LSD makes you nuts. And this is a fantastic book. And so that caused me to question everything. And then when I was almost 18, I started taking LSD and mescaline and exploring. And I felt like these drugs had tremendous potential. And then I felt like, you know, my bar mitzvah when I was 13 did not turn me into a man, but I thought maybe these psychedelics could. So, and then when I woke up to all of it in 1972, it was shortly after the backlash and had pretty much wiped out psychedelic research. And then also Nixon was saying that Timothy Leary was the most dangerous man in America. And that made me think, what is Timothy Leary doing that's so right? It's got Nixon so scared. So, you know, I just had a lot of difficulties, though. I should acknowledge that I had a lot of difficulties with my LSD experiences. I wasn't fully able to integrate them, to process them. And I went to the guidance counselor at my school, New College of Florida in Sarasota, Florida. And the guidance counselor, I said, help me with my tripping. And the guidance counselor said, okay, that's a legitimate thing. And he gave me this book to read by Stan Grof, the world's leading LSD researcher. It was Realms of the Human Unconscious. And that book put it all together for me. So that's what really did it. This was science looking at religion, looking at spirituality, talking about how the unit of mystical experience can be generated by psychedelics and has been valued for that for thousands of years. And once you identify as part of this collective, then you don't dehumanize others. You realize we're all more the same than different. And I thought, okay, I'm going to go to jail for being a draft resister, or I thought I would. I won't be able to have a normal career, but I could have an underground career as a psychedelic therapist. And so that's how I decided at age 18. Huh. And then I should add that everything since then has been about moving from identifying myself as a counterculture drug-using criminal to a mainstream legal drug user.
All right. So, can I ask, are you still using psychedelics?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to ask that question?
Of course, yeah. I think they're valuable throughout the lifespan. I think they're particularly valuable when you're young, when you try to figure out what you want to do with your life, vision quests. You know, in adolescence and early 20s, I think that's where a lot of times people experiment. And now, of course, I'm talking about a healthy society where everybody has peer drugs and has support for that. And then I think psychedelics are particularly useful near the ending stages of your life. You know, when you start thinking about death, you start thinking about the legacy of your life. You start thinking about how you want to use the remaining time more effectively. So I do think that psychedelics have a role throughout the lifespan. And I feel for me that, you know, I'll never be able to pay back with all of my political work. I'll never be able to pay back the benefits I receive from psychedelics and marijuana.
When you talk about psychedelics, what medicines, what are you talking about? It's more than just marijuana. It's more than just LSD. What are you talking about?
Well, you know, MAPS, our name is Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And we define psychedelics the way it was originally defined, which is mind manifesting. So psychedelic is anything that's mind manifesting. Dreams are psychedelic. I particularly focus on MDMA, ecstasy or Molly, however people have heard about it. That's our main area of research, which I do consider to be a psychedelic, but it's not like a classic psychedelic. It's more of a it doesn't dissolve the ego in the same way. It's more emotional. It's more open-hearted. But it does bring things up from the unconscious. And, you know, one of the things that we found linked back to your early discussion about memory is that a lot of times traumatic memories are suppressed because they're so painful. And we find that under MDMA, people's memory for the trauma is enhanced. And yet, when these memories that are linked to fear come to the surface and people can process them in a safe way, in a supportive way, then the healing is even deeper. So MDMA has this incredible impact on memory where things come to the surface when they were too painful to do that before. So we also, meditation is psychedelic in different ways. But in general, MAPS focuses on research with marijuana and research with MDMA.
And how do you get your MDA?
Well, MDMA. So MDMA.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. Well, and this actually will be good for your listeners because the FDA is, for the last 25 years, has put science over politics when it comes to research with Schedule I drugs, meaning psychedelics and marijuana for us. There are multiple companies around the world that have licenses to produce MDMA or psilocybin or any other chemicals. But in the United States, there is a federal monopoly on the supply of marijuana. And this monopoly has been in existence since 1968. The University of Mississippi has been the only federally legal grower, and they grow under contract to the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And their marijuana is only for research. It's never something that can be sold as a commercial product. So therefore, marijuana can never be made into a prescription medicine because the phase three final pivotal studies that we're entering into now for MDMA require that you use the exact same drug that you want to market. And since the night of marijuana cannot be marketed, there's no way to do phase three studies. So that's the sneaky way that the DEA, that the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the Drug Czar's Office have blocked marijuana from becoming a federally legal medicine because there is no way to do the research to make that happen. Now, the summer of 2016, under Obama, the DEA published a notice in the Federal Register saying that they would end the monopoly on marijuana. And since then, about 26 applicants have gone ahead and applied for licenses. But none of them have received the license. Under Attorney General Sessions, all licenses have been blocked. So that's the problem with marijuana. But with MDMA, we're getting it from a company in England, and we're getting I just received an email shortly before your show, actually, that we're getting 1.9 kilograms manufactured of GMP medical grade MDMA. It's
now,
pretty incredible.
I could not get that from them. Could I? You have to have all kinds of clearances, or how anybody can attend MDAs in this country, could they?
No. Well, you can order it, but it only gets shipped to DEA licensed researchers. So I mean, you could conceivably buy it and have it made. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to have it made.
Really?
And then it's about. Yeah, we're spending well over $1 million on getting GMP medical grade MDMA made, and then getting it encapsulated because you have to do the phase three research.
Rick, I got to ask you a question here. It's costing millions of dollars to get this product. It doesn't cost very much to make that. Who's making all this money?
Well, it's how it's made. It's made in a special way where they test everything about temperature, pressure, the impurities. You have to get it well over 99% pure. It's not that expensive, and it's to do in a laboratory, and it's not that expensive to stick it into capsules. But everything is done to make it into a prescription medicine. I mean, we're having to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on stability studies to show how long it lasts.
I mean, I actually had MDMA made in 1985 at Purdue University, and I had a kilogram made by Dr. Dave Nichols, and 32 years later, that's the same MDMA we're still using in our phase two studies. So MDMA is an incredibly stable molecule. So, but we have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to do more stability studies with the new batch and with the MDMA in the capsules. So, these are just FDA regulations, and that's just what you have to do.
You just have to live through it. Well, listen, Rick, we've got to take a short little break here, but I want to get back, and I want to talk more about your research in, of psychedelics and what's going on and the work that you're doing to educate. And it sounds like you're doing some political work as well. Is that correct?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Definitely political work. I'd be glad to talk about that.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. So we'll be back. Just hang tight for about 2 or 3 minutes, and we'll be right back to talk with you some more.
Okay. Great,
let's see. Right now, I want to let you know about Higher Power 420. It's one of the ways we pay for this program. The program doesn't cost a lot, but it costs a little bit, and you can help it, and you could do it by purchasing a print of Higher Power 420. That's right, Higher Power 420. It's a gorgeous and mind-boggling limited edition print depicting everyone's favorite deities in a joyous 420 celebration. Conceived and designed by moi and artistically rendered by Shane Master Creation Hibbets, Higher 420 is an engaging, thought-provoking, and satiric look at the foibles of religion and the role marijuana can play in today's polarized and estranged world. That's the core of Higher Power 420. It's a beautiful art print. Once I said, depicting the gathering together of the iconic religious figures of today, enjoying each other's company. Your favorite deity is at a joyous 420 celebration as they escape from their inherent incessant squabbles, as we relax and enjoy each other's company while sharing their common, albeit supernatural, humanity. Only cannabis could allow them to kick back with each other as well as help them overlook and forget about their adherents' competing claims to theistic dominance. In Higher Power 420, they share it all with each other. It's a limited edition iconograph. Each 16-inch by 20-inch art print is signed and numbered by the artist and myself and comes with a certificate of authenticity. Be the first to have one adorn the wall of your home or office. It's sure to be a conversation starter in any situation. It also makes the perfect gift for your sophisticated cannabis connoisseur friends. The holidays are coming up, you're thinking, what am I going to give this friend of mine? They have everything. What's Higher Power 420 to put on their wall? And you can see it. How can you see it? You can go to higherpower420.com. That's right. Higher Power 420, that's 420, you don't have to spell it out, higherpower420.com, and you can see the print and you can order it. The cost is only $24.20, and that includes all shipping and handling charges. So, once again, take a look at it, get a print for yourself, get a print for your friend. It's all at higherpower420.com. Buy one, enjoy one, and help support our radio show right here on Blog Talk Radio. Okay, well, Elsie, I want to let you know, if you find my introductory op-ed, like today I talked about memory loss and why that's good for you. The last show, if you listen to the last show, I talked about the overproduction of cannabis and what this cannabis production bubble that's occurring here in the state of California and what it means. If you find that interesting, then you should subscribe to my free email newsletter. And you can do it very simply by going to www.marijuananews.org. That's one word, marijuananews.org. So you have to know how to spell marijuana, and I imagine you know how to spell news. connect the two words together, marijuananews.org. And when you bring up the website at the top of the page, you'll see newsletter. Click on newsletter, fill out the put in your email address and the other requested information, and you will start receiving my newsletter. Now, I assure you, you will not, your email basket will not be inundated by me once you do this. I only send out the newsletter two or three times a month, so you won't get it all the time, and I don't send the email address to anybody else. And if you decide that my newsletter is not the wonderful basket of information that I am telling you it is, you can easily unsubscribe. Just go to the bottom and say unsubscribe, and my newsletter will no longer darken your email basket. But I think once you start reading it, that you will enjoy it. So just go to marijuananews.org, and you will find my newsletter there. One other thing, if you notice when you log into Blog Talk Radio, you'll see a little follow button there. I would appreciate if you would become a follower. If you click on it, it will bring you a notice once in a while of when I put on a new radio show. I only do two a month, so you're not going to exactly get overwhelmed with that. But by the more followers I get, the higher up our show goes on the Blog Talk Radio pecking ladder. And the higher up the ladder you go, the more publicity you get. And the more publicity you get, that means the more people are going to listen to your show and more people are going to learn the truth about marijuana and hear the intelligent dissertations by people like Rick Doblin. So please become a follower. All right, so now let us go bring Rick back into the studio and continue with our interview with Rick Doblin and psychedelics and naps. Rick, welcome back into the studio.
Great, yes, I'm happy to be back, Glenn.
Okay, we're happy to have you back. So what other, besides, so you mainly do your research on MDMA. Is that a dangerous drug? They're always making out like, you know, we know marijuana was always made out to be, you know, a dangerous drug, which is nonsense. Is the dangers of MDMA also overrated, or is it truly has some dangerous properties to it?
Well, I'd say that every drug has certain dangers. Even marijuana has dangers. But, you know, for medicine, you look at the balance of dangers or risks and benefits. And, you know, no drug works for everybody, so no drug has unlimited benefits, and no drug has unlimited risks either. So MDMA, in certain contexts, meaning people who take MDMA at raves, at dances, that are conducted in hot areas where they've turned off the water so that people will buy alcohol, people can overheat, and people have died from dancing and overheating on MDMA. People have heard about how you need to take water so you don't overheat. So there's been a few cases of people drinking too much water and dying from what's called hyponatremia. You know, MDMA can bring things to the surface. That's how it's emotional issues to the surface, and that's why it's so useful in therapy. But if people are in a recreational setting and they're out to have a party and difficult emotional material comes up and then they say, I don't want to talk about it or think about it because I'm here with my friends supposedly to have a party. And then when you stuff the emotions back down, then people can end up worse off rather than better. So it's all about the context and how it's used, the dosage that determines this relative balance between risks and benefits. But I should add that there's been well over 1,100 people who have received MDMA in clinical research around the world for about the last 25 years. And there's never been any serious adverse event related to the MDMA. So we believe that in a therapeutic setting, MDMA is extremely safe, especially since we're only talking about giving it a few times in the context of psychotherapy. So our therapeutic approach is 3.5 months and roughly 12 90-minute non-drug psychotherapy sessions, more or less once a week. And then there's only 3 days, day-long sessions with MDMA, 1 month apart. So MDMA in those circumstances, I believe, is not dangerous. It's actually, you know, very beneficial.
So it's very beneficial in a very strictly controlled situation. But unlike marijuana, which you can't overdose on, and people use it all the time, daily, that's not necessarily a good thing to do with MDMA. In other words, it shouldn't be available over the counter, for example, like marijuana is going to be available here in California over the counter.
Well, let me disagree with you on that one.
Okay.
And I think the fundamental position I have is that prohibition is counterproductive. So MDMA as a medicine should not be available over the counter. It should only be administered under direct supervision of therapists. And that's what we'll be proposing to the FDA. But MDMA should also be available over the counter for people who want to do it for any number of different reasons. And so I think that when you have systems of prohibition, they end up being counterproductive. People end up buying impure drugs and getting hurt from those. People take them in situations where they're worried about the police, and that increases anxiety and fear. People take the drugs right away so that they don't have them on their possession, whereas if it wasn't illegal, they would wait for the more proper time and place. So
I absolutely agree with you 100%. Prohibition only makes things worse. What I was getting at, though, is where a person can buy marijuana and consume it and consume it and consume it and consume it, and they're not going to overdose. Can you overdose on MDMA dangerously if you take too much?
Yeah, I think you can. I mean, MDMA increases blood pressure. And, you know, for people that have weak hearts, you could take a large amount of MDMA, and it could be problematic. However, you know, we also have the situation where because MDMA is an illegal drug and it's highly desired, there are tens and tens of millions of people that have taken it over multiple decades. And so you almost never hear of anybody having a heart attack from MDMA. So, you know, there are issues. It's conceivable that you could overdose. But you can overdose on water. That's what I was trying to say.
What I'm hearing from you, what I wanted to get from you, is that it's relatively safe that to overdose on it, you really have to kind of go to extremes that most people would never do in the first place.
Yeah, there's what's called the therapeutic index, which is the ratio between the therapeutic drug and the harm, you know, the deadly amount. And you know, there's quite a distance. There's a good therapeutic index. It's not like people are right on that edge of recreational use. If they take just a little bit more, they're going to die. It's not like that at all. And in fact, there's very, very few deaths. I mean, these deaths from overheating could be solved easily by appropriate harm reduction policies. But
absolutely,
we have a perverse society where, you know, with prohibition, harm reduction approaches get criminalized as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely correct there. That's one of the crazy things. But, you know, this crazy attitude about drugs and this thing, sometimes it makes me wonder, how in the world did you ever get – you're with the University of Massachusetts. Is that correct?
No. No.
We're
trying to get a license at UMass Amherst to grow marijuana. But Mass, you know, is a nonprofit organization. Once I got my PhD from Harvard, from the Kennedy School of Government, I was no longer directly affiliated with an academic institution. We're sponsoring research at New York University. We'll be working at UC San Francisco. We've done research at UCLA and Harvard Medical School, all sorts of places. But personally, I'm just a full-time employee of MAPS, trying to develop MAPS as a nonprofit pharmaceutical company focused on psychedelics and marijuana, and trying to develop these drugs into FDA-approved prescription medicines.
So is the eventual goal of MAPS actually to become a pharmaceutical company that is manufacturing and distributing these psychedelic drugs?
Exactly, yeah.
Wow.
And we are already a nonprofit pharmaceutical company in that we have conducted research since 1992, actually, is when we started conducting FDA-approved research with MDMA. So it's been 25 years already that we've been working on it. And November 29th, 2016, So about a year ago, we had what's called the end of phase two meeting with FDA. When FDA said, yes, we could move to phase three studies for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD. And we just recently, August 15th, FDA declared MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD a breakthrough therapy. It's the most important program that FDA has for the most valuable, promising drugs. And if we make MDMA into a medicine, it's off patent. It was invented by Merck in 1912. And we actually have hired patent attorneys to develop anti-patent strategies. So nobody can patent the whole range of uses for MDMA. But still, under Ronald Reagan, the Congress passed a law that provides incentives for people to develop drugs that are off patent. And so if we develop MDMA into a medicine, the FDA has a program called data exclusivity. And what that means is nobody could use our data to market it as a generic for 5 years. And then you get an extra 6 months if you do studies in children and pediatric studies. And the FDA is actually requiring us to do studies in adolescents with PTSD. But we won't have to do those until after the drug is approved for adults. So there's a period of time where we may be the only people selling MDMA. Other people could do their own research, and that would be fine for MDMA for PTSD, or they could research MDMA for something else. So the data exclusivity is not a patent, but it is a very valuable situation. And so we anticipate that we will be able to market MDMA, and we will be the organization that does it. Now, selling MDMA for more than it costs us is profit-making business. It's not something that can stay inside the nonprofit. So we've created what's called the Mass Public Benefit Corporation. And so that's a new form of capitalism where what you're doing is maximizing social benefit, not profits. And it's a for-profit company. Taxes will be paid. But we only have one investor in the Benefit Corp, which is the nonprofit. So the nonprofit owns the company that's going to market MDMA. So MAPS and the MAPS Public Benefit Corp will be the way in which we move forward as a pharmaceutical company.
So it's going to be nonprofit. So the idea is this drug will be available at reasonable prices.
Oh, completely reasonable. Yeah, because you know our goal is really social change through enhancing the mental health of our citizens. Which, you know, looking at current politics, you could say we need a lot of that.
So you feel that MDMA would help mellow out society?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So look at so many people that are sort of stuck in patterns of multi-generational trauma. You know, we have conflicts that are passed down from generation to generation to generation. We know that from what's called epigenetics, which is that, you know, the genetics and genetic evolution takes a long time. But epigenetics is about how whatever your genes are, not all of them are turned on or turned off. And so you can change in one generation people's sort of set points of fear, of anxiety, of. So I think that if you MDMA will promote empathy, compassion, it will help heal trauma. We're even talking about using it in areas where there'll be MDMA for conflict resolution. It makes people better listeners, understand people's concerns more. So, yeah, I think MDMA will have a tremendous impact on the public mental health.
Well, this kind of sounds like, when you originally described how it's used, where it's used very sparingly and all this kind of stuff, it sounds like you're talking about this is something that would be used very frequently by people.
No, I don't think very frequently, but I think it should be used by it should be available for patients, but also for people who are not patients. And I don't think it takes a lot of – so it doesn't need to be used very frequently, but it can be very profound. Just a few experiences.
And
same is
so
true with psilocybin or LSD.
Just a few experiences will set the, like you said, a set point will change the way you view and operate within the world.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's what the research is showing now with psilocybin. Or even our MDMA research, we're showing, we have people, you know, our phase two studies, our pilot studies in Israel, Switzerland, U.S., and Canada had 107 people, and they had PTSD an average of over 17 years. And 1 year after the last treatment, two-thirds of them no longer have PTSD. And that's after only three MDMA sessions, and some of them only had two MDMA sessions.
It's kind of an epiphany drug. You take it,
yes,
and you have this great awakening, and you don't need it again after you have the great awakening.
Yes, that's right. Although we want to get away from this idea of one-dose miracle cure. So
yes,
it's embedded in a therapeutic process. Sometimes people need two or three doses, as we do, set spaced a month apart. And it can be profoundly helpful, and then people are free of drugs. I mean, we've even had people, veterans in our study, we do a lot of work with veterans with PTSD. We had one veteran who was struggling with PTSD and also using opiates for pain. And under the influence of MDMA, he realized that he was addicted to the opiates. He wasn't really using them for pain. He was using them for escape. And he felt that his one MDMA session cured his PTSD and made him think he didn't need opiates, and he stopped using opiates. And this is about 7 years ago.
Would MDA be beneficial for the Republican Party?
Well, MDMA would be.
I get it backwards,
yeah.
Don't I? I'm so sorry. MDMA would it be?
No, no,
it's
okay. MDA is a drug that's more psychedelic, more visual in the sense, more classic psychedelic. MDA, but MDMA is a gentler version of it.
Oh, wait a minute. So you got MDMA and let me
MDA.
Write this down. You got MDMA and you got
MDA. MDA was big in the 60s.
Yeah, and you're working on MDMA.
Right. Now, there's also MMDA. There's all these different modifications of the molecule.
Right.
But we're working with MDMA.
Is MDMA, well, I think we talked earlier in the show, is that the same thing as ecstasy?
Yes, yeah. Although ecstasy is often fake.
Yeah.
Or
has
other drugs in it. But,
oh, yeah,
yeah,
absolutely correct. So, but what I'm getting at is, you know, when I say, you know, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, would MDMA be beneficial to the Republican Party? Will it change their attitudes if they did it?
Well, I think a lot of what is motivating Republicans is fear and anxiety.
Uh-huh.
And then they're not thinking rationally. And MDMA can help people process fear and anxiety. And then once you're clear and you're not so much motivated by fear and anxiety, I think you can think more clearly. You can be more compassionate. So, yeah, I think that... the other thing that the Republican, one of the things that was clear after the election was that the counties in America that had what are called despair deaths, and despair deaths is referred to as usually white, middle-aged, non-college-educated people who die from suicide, alcoholism, or opiate addiction. And if you correlate those areas of America, those counties that have larger numbers of despair deaths, they tended to vote more for Trump. And so I think that Ibogaine, which is a psychedelic drug from Western Africa that is very useful for the treatment of opiate addiction, that it could be a useful drug. But, you know, let's just say this too. A lot of Democrats need the
yes,
sensitivity training as well, and you look at all the stuff that's coming out about sexual abuse by various Democrat politicians. So it's not just that it's everybody needs emotional enhancement and maturation.
Absolutely true. It's you're right. It's universal. I had mentioned earlier, just before we took our break, that we were going to talk a little bit about the political ramifications of what you're doing, and you said you had some very very good, strong thoughts on those. Could you kind of touch on the political ramifications of what you're doing?
Well, and I'd say for all of your listeners that are mostly interested in marijuana, that the political battles with marijuana are crucial right now. And in the work that we're trying to do is break the federal monopoly on the production of marijuana. And so, as I said, under President Obama, the DEA agreed that they would license additional producers. 26 applicants or so have applied since then. And Attorney General Sessions is blocking the DEA from issuing any of those licenses. So we're trying to work with Republican senators led by Orrin Hatch, who is sympathetic with ending the NIDA, the National Assessment on Drug Abuse, monopoly on the production of federally legal DEA-licensed marijuana. So we need whoever is listening to contact their senators and say, contact Attorney General Sessions and demand that he license additional producers of marijuana and end the federal government monopoly. So that's one of our big political battles right now.
Yeah, very true. Okay. Listen, I just have to ask you, we've got to wrap this up, but I got to ask you one thing. In the beginning of the program, I talked about the fact that you conducted a study, a follow-up to Timothy Leary's Concord Prison Experiment, which administered psilocybin-based med to prisoners in an effort to reduce recidivism. Did that work?
Not really, no. Timothy Leary reported that it worked. And that's why I wanted to do, you know, this long-term follow-up study to that study, because I thought it would bring attention to a tremendously successful study. But the more that I got into it, the more I realized that the data that I was finding did not match with what Timothy Leary reported. But even Timothy Leary recognized early on that you can give people a new start. You can give them psilocybin while they're still in prison, and you can end up working through some of their issues and giving them new motivation to be a good citizen. But once they get out of prison, they need support services. And it's the same way with what I was talking about, Ibogaine or drug detox. You can help people detox from drugs, but what you also need is support afterwards to help them not go back to the same old patterns. And so Timothy Leary, Ralph Metzner, Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, they all realized that they needed to combine the psilocybin experiences in prison with support groups once people got out of prison. And they started doing that, but then they got kicked out of Harvard right after that. So what my conclusion is about the experiment is that even though it didn't show benefits long term, that a different kind of an approach with psilocybin or with MDMA while people are in prison combined with post-release support groups could very well be tremendously helpful.
Okay. I'll buy into that. Well, listen, Rick, I want to thank you very much for taking the time. If people would like to get more information about MAPS and what you're doing, how could they do that?
MAPS.org, M-A-P-S, MAPS.org. We have a year-end fundraising campaign to support our MDMA PTSD research, or people could restrict it to our marijuana study. Any donations on the donation page can be restricted to particular projects. Or you can just sign up for our newsletter, anything like that, at MAPS.org.
You know, interesting, when you said, you know, any donations and stuff, you're a company.
We're a nonprofit, so people get tax deductions for donating to MAPS.
Right, taxes. So you don't have shareholders in a nonprofit company, do you? So I can't buy stock in MAPS.
No, and in fact, you know, we could have shareholders in the benefit corp, but we refuse. We don't want that. We want this all controlled by the nonprofit with no investors. People have often, you know, making MDMA into a medicine for phase three is going to cost about $26 million. We have $18 million pledged or in hand in multi-year commitments. And we need another $8 million. And several people have said they would invest that $8 million. And we told them, no, we're only going for donations.
Okay, very good. Well, Rick, thank you so much for being on the show. You've been extremely illuminating. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners did too. Best of what you're doing, and I hope to see it on the market and available at Rite Aid within the next couple of years.
Well, it won't be that way because it's only going to be sold to the therapist, not to the patient. It's not take-home drug. It's not going to be prescribed to patients. The therapist doctors that are going to prescribe it will receive the MDMA from a mail-order pharmacy probably, and then they will directly administer it to the patient. So there's no take-home drug. It's fundamentally different than marijuana in that way, but it's very easy to regulate from the DEA point of view.
Very true. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Maybe we'll be looking to read all about it and keep on going for what you're doing. It's so important in so many different ways. I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to. Public education is crucial, so thank you for the opportunity for that.
Thanks, Rick. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Okay, Rick Doblin from the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies and MDMA. I had no idea about I always heard of MDMA when I was growing up, or not when I was growing up, but later on about ecstasy and all this kind of stuff. It's absolutely fascinating. You know, the stories you hear, well, it's kind of just like the reefer madness stories of that we have grown up with. We've also grown up with MDMA madness stories as well. Anyway, once you check it out at maps.org. Well, thank you so much for listening to the show. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please tell your friends all about Marijuana Compassion and Common Sense. We are the show. We are the show that tells you the truth about marijuana. Please let your friends know, let your colleagues know, let your family members know. This is the show to listen to on blogtalkradio.com/marijuana news.